Blog Talk Radio.
It's not just Washington that is broken, it's America who is asleep at the wheel. Why do they tell us that the Constitution is outdated? Can you outdate liberty? This is Brett Rappaport, and you are listening to the Final Say Radio Show. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to the Final Say Radio Show. It's Brett and John Rappaport and Andrew on the boards. Got a busy show for you, as always, with a ton of topics. And, of course, it's Tuesday, so James S. Robbins will be joining us, as he does every afternoon. I want to yesterday we started off covering something in New York State, Cuomo's plan with the prisons and not having juveniles go to adult prisons anymore. Discuss that a little bit. We're not going to get into that today, but we're going to get into just real quickly, and I'm not going to spend too much time on this, but I would, you know, I always felt in doing this program all these years, I've tried my best to stay away from local politics, and that's, you know, constantly talking about New York, New Jersey, and things of that nature. We've tried to talk about things on a more of a national issue, but I believe that in the case of some of these things, that they really are national issues, and well, just point to, when I say this next word, the topic of the article and what we're discussing here, you'll understand how I correlate it to Washington, D.C., and, well, I guess really the whole world, but corruption. There, I said it. Prosecutors launch attack on corruption. Of course, this is prosecutors in New York State, and we've seen in recent years many big names going down. I guess most of which have been in the Democratic Party. You know, Tammany Hall's back, yes, if you know your history. The corruption that has plagued New York for so long is getting worse. Sheldon Silver being brought in last week or 2 weeks ago. But there's a lot more corruption going on. And what's interesting to me in this particular case is that when Governor Cuomo and this is really amazing to me. But when he took office, they set up a something called the Moreland Commission, and it was an investigation into public corruption. And basically, they closed down the commission and said, you know, for the most part, nothing to see here. Nothing to see here. We're just going to move along from that. So anyway. The interesting thing about that is that after Governor Cuomo, who has ambitions to run for president, it's been known, it's been said, it's been talked about, and he's responsible for getting the political points for making a statement such as, I'm going to deal with corruption. But he's even more responsible for not doing anything about it and for really putting up the obstacles, such as the Moreland Commission, from allowing corruption to be properly dealt with. So fortunately, we have prosecutors who have political ambitions as well. And the best way for, you know, you look at a lot of guys like, you know, Giuliani's a good example, Chris Christie. You know, these are how guys make their names known. Either in their states or nationally, and that's by going after bad people. And so it's not a bad thing. I mean, if you get a little bit of a reward politically and your name has good credibility that comes along with it because of, you know, prosecuting corruption, I think that's a good thing. So just to take the points out of this and then we'll move on, is that there's a lot of corruption in New York. There's certainly a lot of corruption in New Jersey. there's just the New Jersey's like a lost cause. I'm sorry, there's just nobody. There is no New Jersey watchdog because it's almost completely outside of a handful of counties, completely controlled by the Democrats. And it, you know, I don't even know what Christie is, to be honest with you. And we're not going to get into that conversation because it's like it's laughable. I mean, New Jersey is just a laughing stock of a state, and it's really sad because it's a beautiful state. It's a state I've lived in almost my entire life, and it's a state I'd love to stay in. And feel like, my gosh, it's like almost torture to continue to stay here. So anyway, that's my little bit on corruption for today, and we'll move along to some of the other things that really need to be addressed, only because they're so significant. And John, it's funny because we brought this up yesterday, and you're not gonna believe it, but if you opened up your Wall Street Journal, folks. And I know you're going to want to comment on this because we had a very interesting discussion, John, with Dan Kish from the Institute for Energy Research yesterday. And of course, we must have led the story because we discussed where oil price is going. And so on the front, I mean, the very top story of the front page of the Wall Street Journal today, after we discussed it yesterday, is oil price rebound predicted. Global Monitor cites spending cuts by crude producers, decline in U.S. drilling. So, John, they're predicting, let me see, the benchmark U.S. oil price rose 2.3% to $52.86 a barrel on Monday and is up 19% from a nearly six-year low, which it hit last month. So I guess they're predicting it to come back up. I think it's going to stabilize somewhere in the 50s for a little while. And who knows, it's probably going to jump all over the place. I just hope it stays kind of low for a little while because it's definitely, I think, in our best interest. But, John, don't you find that kind of interesting that that's the leading story today?
Well, it doesn't really surprise me because there is a lot of volatility. And let's be clear, there's a couple of really powerful players involved here. You know, we didn't completely finish telling the story yesterday, but one of the biggest challenges that you have here is if you think about one of the greatest motivators for a country right now who arguably has the most fear, even more so perhaps than Israel, is Saudi Arabia. Because Israel knows that as bad as this president is, it still has Congress on its side, which is why I'm glad to see Netanyahu is ignoring all the tenderfeet folks and actually going ahead to speak with Congress. The far-left liberals who want to turn their back to him, be damned. But anyway, but they're in a much better position to actually defend themselves. Saudi Arabia is not in a great, even though for all the military equipment they've bought, they have very little experience using it. And Saudi Arabia is not in a particularly great position vis-a-vis Iran, who is very aggressive, very hegemonic, and the two of them are absolute dead-set enemies. And our president, as we've discussed many times, is literally flying air cover and paving the path for Saudi Arabia's destruction. Now, the 9/12 man in me would love that if it didn't have to do with Iran. But kind of this is almost like a repeat, and this is something I really haven't heard. But when I look at what's going on right now between Saudi Arabia and Syria, I'm sorry, Saudi Arabia and Iran, is very similar to where we were with Iran-Iraq. And if you want to make the argument, the only argument that I consider absolutely valid about why we never should have gone into Iraq was because we had two no-good SOBs who were willing to continue to kill each other and not focus on other people around the world so much. That's probably a good thing when you're dealing with crazy people. In this case, Saudi Arabia has a lot to lose. And so what can Saudi Arabia do to defend themselves right now? Non-militarily. Two things. Well, one thing with two great impacts. If they keep the price of oil artificially low, they reduce the amount of cash flowing into Iran. That's very important for them. Number two, and as well as the Soviet Union, yeah, I said it, Soviet Union, it's back. Call it whatever you want. Call it the Russian Federation, but it's the same animal rearing its ugly head. But if it also neuters them, it also helps to prevent some of that additional support for Iranian hegemony. The second is to destroy, or at minimum undermine, the investor return on fracking in the U.S. And so here you have our president, who is the exact opposite. You would think, as we discussed in yesterday's show, it was one of the most important things Dan Tisch said, was that it is a very strategic national and global asset. You know, and the fact that the president is doing the exact opposite, not only is he not taking a drill baby drill independent attitude, but he's actually stifling and turning off more, you know, access to this, find other ways that if the price stayed artificially low to artificially raise the price, and he's doing everything possible to support Iran and to undermine the Saudi Arabian efforts. Now, so I say this, Brett, because Saudi Arabia is not our friend. They are not doing this for altruistic purposes. They are doing it because it is in their best interest, and if I was them, that's exactly what I would do. It makes good sense. So what we need is a president who thinks like that. We should be doing whatever we could, from increasing our national reserves, buying up, you know, a couple of billion more barrels, by opening the pipelines, opening ANWR, and even providing for a subsidy fund. Well, I'm not a big fan of subsidizing business. I think, for example, just because we have, we're in a peacetime, for example, or maybe the rest of the world is not buying weapon systems at a rate that would help to keep our weapon systems manufacturers in good shape, I think we spend more. I think there are certain industries that you absolutely need to keep alive. Well, you want to talk about too big to fail? The ability to protect ourselves and the ability to be energy independent, Brett, is what I would truly call too big to fail.
Yeah, I mean, you want to talk about a jobs program. I'll give you a jobs program. And, you know, it's a multi-part program here. And we have a whole heck of, I mean, just such a large piece of infrastructure that needs to be addressed. And whether our good friends from the Center for Security Policy and the London Center and others who are always discussing EMP and the taking down of the grid. So you have the hard-hitting of our grid, which is, you know, there's been various estimates, but let's just say that it's completely off the wall, crazy investment of just a few billion dollars to take the steps necessary. Well, these aren't McDonald's jobs that would be created. It's not contracts that would sustain jobs that people will still have to suck off the government. They're real jobs that would be created. So I'm okay with that kind of a program. But then again, and we don't discuss this enough, and this is the, you want to call it the Soviet Union, whatever we want to refer to them as these days, the Russian Federation, if you will, I guess is the appropriate term at the moment. But Putin and his ambitions in the Arctic exploration and going after oil. Now, I guess he's laying claim to something that isn't necessarily, you know, his. So where the argument is there, I don't know. I mean, if we had a real president, we would be having the discussion of who the Arctic really belongs to. And for all we know, we don't know what's going on by the Russian Federation on American property in Alaska or otherwise because of where they already are. So that's another concern. So for all the environmentalists, I'm bringing this up for a specific reason. For all of the environmentalists who are constantly telling us about the fact that we can't, and here, I'll break your myth too. We shouldn't be exploring for natural gas and for oil, and we certainly shouldn't have pipelines, and we certainly shouldn't have coal because it's all bad for the environment, but it's okay to ship it on train lines that are owned by Warren Buffett, and it's certainly okay to use coal and other natural resources that are required to make the components of batteries for electric cars and for solar panels and for wind turbines and all this other stuff. So it's all a bunch of bunk to begin with. But here's the thing. Do you think the Russians have as much concern about the environment as we do when it comes to how they are exploring and how they are dealing with the taking of the oil from the ground, if you will? I don't think so. I really don't think so. So there could be an equal amount of damage to the Arctic and to the Alaska region as anything that we could ever do as a result of an accident, because we don't purposely do these things. I mean, honestly, it's like the Exxon Valdez, that wasn't, you know, they're accidents that happen. These things aren't done on purpose. It's like, it drives you nuts. I mean, it's sad to see the pictures of birds covered in oil and, you know, all the wildlife that's impacted and things of that nature. But these things happen, and you deal with them, and you try to avoid them. In fact, I would make the argument that it's the environmentalists that really screwed up the Gulf of Mexico and everything that happened with the Gulf oil spill. Because hadn't we created the right amount of regulation and stuff that forced the drilling so far out and so deep, then the requirements and difficulty in drilling at that depth would have been much less, and the chances of that type of accident would have been minimized. And common sense. If you drill at 2,500 feet as opposed to 5,000 feet, John, fewer things can go wrong because you're dealing with less pressure, less issues than you would at lower depths. I mean, so who did that? The environmentalists should be paying up a little bit here, right?
Yeah, even the far left Hollywood crowd understands this theory, because how many movies have we seen, whether they're undersea, out in space, or in the Arctic or out back somewhere, where part of the adventure movie and part of the risk and the excitement is the fact that we're all alone. We need a hero because we can't be reached or rescued in time. I mean, this is a common theme for movies. So this is not like, oh my God, we just had no idea. This is an unpredictable event. So reasonable minds, not brilliant minds, could understand that this is an obvious unintended consequence. You know, we talk about unintended consequences. It's something we frequently discuss here when we tie in foreign policy considerations. But unintended consequences in some cases are wildly unpredictable, like what happens sometimes in a pool game where you drop the eight ball and everybody's scratching their head going, never saw that coming. But in many cases like this, unintended consequences are very predictable. And I think that's an enormous problem. So, I wanted to add to this too, Brett. You made the comment about there are things that just happen in nature, and they're catastrophic. And even without man's intervention, we've seen tsunamis, we've seen earthquakes, tornadoes, hurricanes. I mean, that nature is capable of unbelievable destruction on a whim. It's brutal. It always has been. Dan, there are some real man-made disasters. But I always try to remind people of the risks of not doing things like this. We can have extra legislation. We can have extra bonds. You can have a higher level of proof requirement, for example, on the foundation of a pipeline or on the on the ceiling of the joints, or for proof temperature and pressure and sun and other things that might allow seals to break and leak. You can increase those things. But look at the other side of the risk, okay? Unintended consequences of Desert Storm, if you recall. I forget how many oil wells there were, but there were literally thousands, amazing number. And by the way, if you remember, some of the companies that were putting these oil wells out were the same companies that a lot of the people on the left love to bash as, the war profiteers, right? But think about the environmental devastation that was happening, per second when they blew up. I wish I could recall the numbers, Beth, but if I recall, it was somewhere in the 1,500 or even 2,000 to 3,000 oil well heads. I mean, it was a staggering number, every one of which is itself a big challenge to put out. These are the unintended consequences. Now, imagine the unintended consequences of a nuclear arms race in the Middle East. Wait. So I'm a little less worried about Anwar, I got to tell you.
Yeah, John, one of our Vito in the chat room brings up a good point. Obama and the EPA decimating the coal industry as we're having this conversation. We're going to transition in just a moment, but I have to say this. When you look at West Virginia and what Obama, I mean, it's almost like he's got a personal vendetta against West Virginia as one state that's being hurt as much or more than anyone. And they could least afford it, really. And really, it's just discrimination is what I see it as. Because we as a people are supposed to look at all of the different things that are available to us. And, you know, when we evaluate energy resources, it's not supposed to be based on ideology. I mean, if that's what you want, then make a personal choice. If as a, as an individual, you don't want to have natural gas and you feel like putting a you know, solar panels on your house, you know, God bless you. But I, as a taxpayer, shouldn't be required to reach into my pocket and hand you over little credits, if you will, so you can go purchase your new source of energy because that's your choice. And this country was supposed to be about choices. And so I look at coal. If West Virginia and the people who work in these coal mines, if they want to endure that which comes along with coal, and it's not all good. I'm not going to, you know, paint pretty pictures that working in, inside these tunnels is a great thing. But what that's what they want to do. That is what has been available to them. That's what they've done for generations. And maybe it's what they want to continue to do, knowing the cost and the ramifications. And quite frankly, there have been incredible improvements, by the way, in safety requirements, which have taken place over time. So it's not the same story as it used to be. But there's still a need for coal. There's still a call for it, and there's still markets for it. So if they want to, they should be allowed to. And, you know, I don't see how West Virginia continuing to take advantage of resources that they have impact on California or on Maine or on Florida or, you know, I'm just saying. It's one thing if you're a state that's next door and you want to have the conversation of, hey, because you're doing this, you're having an impact on our water, so we need to discuss these issues. That's a state-to-state issue. And I'm getting tired of the federal government picking and choosing winners and losers and dictating down to individual states and the people what they think is in our best interest. Because, John, let's face it, no matter what we discuss on this program, we could point to the failures of the federal government, the abuse, the corruption, the absolute waste, and, you know, the just fiscal hole that they've dug for every American and future generations. So they, it's not like they could point to any huge wins here and say, look how successful we are at building things that last. Because the only things that are lasting in this country are things that private individuals have done through innovative means. And, you know, some of which are, were ideas that were failed in government that were taken in, into the private sector and were able to thrive as a result, right?
Well, Brett, I also think you have to be very sober and reflective about what works and what doesn't work. I want to go back to something you said earlier in the show when you opened up talking about corruption in New York and New Jersey. One of the things that bothers me, and it's really amplified via social media, is the fact that so many people are only interested in validation, validation of their predisposed view. So all these people who talk, oh, I'm not prejudiced, that's BS. Everybody's prejudiced. It's just the nature of the beast. Everybody is prejudiced, okay? I'm a libertarian Tea Party guy. I'm a big government Republican guy who likes to talk about
abortion. Hey, I'm not prejudiced. Bothering. I hate everybody.
Yeah. I'm a typical blue dog Democrat, or I'm the new Democrat, right? The socialist progressive, you know, whatever George Soros is willing to fund, we're willing to back. But people come in, and if you listen and you watch what most people do, they're validating only the stuff that matches their predisposed political ideologies. And so what happens is everybody gets away with corruption because I don't care what my guy does. I'm only going to focus on your guy. And we would be so much better off if we got out of the game of validating corruption and got more in the game of validating of invalidating corruption instead of validating your own ideologies. And I wanted to take that one step further. One of the problems we have right now is, and this administration is arguably the worst I could ever conceive of in this regard, and quite frankly, I think Al Gore fits into that exact same camp, is to get, well, a Nobel Peace Prize just for showing up. But try to imagine, Brett, you've worked in the corporate environments before, try to imagine what an economy would be like if you lived in a world where you get a gold star just for showing up. Just for the, you know, the CEO came to your office and said, congratulations, mazel tov, kumbaya, you parked between the little yellow lines.
Well, now hold on a second, John. You're bringing up a very good point, but we have actual examples of this happening. We have millions of high school students who have been graduated from failing school systems, pretending as though they had earned the requirements to deserve the degree, and they've moved out of the high schools to go on to fail because they're not prepared for work. There is no opportunity. They're not even prepared for it if there is opportunity. And look at the result, John. So that's a working case of getting your gold star for not having met the requirements.
Now, it's bad enough, Brett, when it's a kid coming out of school who probably should be working the 12 o'clock shift at Denny's. But we have it all the way up to the most powerful man in the world. The President of the United States got a gold star just for showing up.
Al Gore got
a gold star for showing up. And the reality is, let me just finish the second part of it. It's not just the fact that they're rewarded for showing up. They're rewarded for what they say and not for what they do, and they're not measured against what they say. To me, it's unbelievable. It is absolutely, if you prove, the one thing you could say about Giuliani, I can understand where some people didn't like Giuliani because politically he was a pretty strong guy. So, okay, you could see some people on the left might think he was a little, calling him a Nazi, as many of them did, was a little carried away. But the one thing you could say is he didn't spend a lot of time just talking. He actually did, and he accomplished what he said he would do. And you can't say that for most politicians. When you honestly look at it, there is not a lot of politicians at the highest levels of government that you could say did what they said they were going to do. And they're not measured against it. The news media doesn't hold their feet to the fire, right?
But the overwhelming majority of the policies that Obama has been seeking since taking office have been actually dealing with this type of issue. Because what he's trying to do is he's trying to equalize the outcome. In other words, it doesn't matter what you did to get there. We just want to assure that everybody has the same thing in the end. Sounds like communism to me. But the problem with this, John, is because as he says, well, everybody should be paid $15 at least when you're working, regardless of the job or whatever your qualifications are, and you should also have health care. So, you know, those are two of the main things, John. And it doesn't matter if you work only 20 or 30 hours a week. You should still make the same thing as a doctor, right? But the problem with what he's been doing here, John, is, again, he has not offered anything in terms of solutions at the root causes of why people aren't properly prepared to, instead of what used to be the case, John. In other words, when we were younger and we needed a job, we either created our own job by delivering newspapers, mowing lawns, doing roofing, painting houses, whatever it is that we did. Other people worked in McDonald's. I chose not to. I lifted up a hammer and did roofing and made a lot of money at it too. But, you know, we were pretty entrepreneurial, John. But all of our friends worked in, drug stores and pizza places and restaurants, you know, just to make money while they were young, while they were going through school. And now people expect to just, hey, I'm going to make a career of it in McDonald's or Wendy's or the local CVS. And it doesn't fly. I mean, that's not what your goals and expectation in life should be. You're supposed to work your way up the ladder, not just cut off the ladder halfway up and say, I'd never want to go past the middle rung. In fact, I want to be paid as though I was on the highest rung, and that's the way we're heading. John, it's a complete failure. But to your point, the only reason these policies continue to be pushed is because when a guy like Obama, first as a young kid when he was 26, 28, gets thrown onto as editor of the Harvard's Law Review and all the other things that were paved for him along the way, before and after, it was like he never really earned any of it. It was always because of who he knew, what they were prepping him for, whether he deserved it or not. And then, like you said, a Nobel Peace Prize before he managed to start a few more wars and light half the world on fire. Okay, awesome. Go ahead.
Comrade cronyism is what it is. Listen. I want to go historical here for a minute. One of the things that is very difficult and frustrating for me to watch as an entrepreneur is so much effort to not just a gold star for showing up, but literally to stifle and destroy. And I'm talking about what the president does, not what the president says. The president has spent many times, he's given even some pretty good speeches if you're just listening to the words, but I don't care about the words. The words are irrelevant. I look at the actions. And the actions are the president is very much against small business. Joe had it right, right? Well, Joe the plumber had it right. Now, if you look historically and try to look at some of the captains of industry that build this country, right? If you look, in fact, there's a great historical program that was done on the History Channel looking at the post-Civil War when America really had its industrial revolution right after the Civil War and how some of those guys really changed the nature of things. These were visionary entrepreneurs. Now, many of these guys were no good, hard-charging sons of bitches if you got in their way, but that's a slightly different story. But try to imagine an Obama egalitarian America. Everybody has 40 acres and a mule. So, and the government will tell you when you could sell them, where you could sell them, how many shoehorns you have to produce, and all this kind of stuff. We would have been just like the Soviet Union with those beautiful square box cars that were good for about 6 miles down the road before they started leaking oil. But look at what happened here. We had innovators, captains of industry who came in and they looked into the future, and no different than Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and Sergey Brin and all these guys recently, the Ted Turners and others in the 80s. Look at what some of these guys did. Look at how they came in and they recognized that, hey, oil is going to be, the next big thing. And, so we had railroads, and then we had oil, and then we had steel, and then we had, before that we had shipping, and then we had electricity, right? And there's all these massive trends, just like the internet, right? We had these massive transformative innovations. In some cases, they were newly discovered products. In many cases, they were just totally different innovations, things that we don't even think about now, like running an oil pipeline. At some point, was a massive innovation because, well, you put them in barrels and you ship them on train. So the thing here, Brett, is this is what happens when you have a free, open society. Now, you can make the argument that there was a strong need for unions early on because these captains of industry had too much power. Not so much that they accumulated too much wealth, because the wealth created does, how many jobs were created, how many men made a living laying railroad tracks, building, railroads, conducting trains, all these different things, selling the tickets. But, so you need these kind of crazy people, these visionaries who make a ton if they're successful, because maybe you forget how many of those guys go belly up. You forget how many investors have to write off when the train boom hit, and how many hundreds of railroad companies went out of business, and how many investors that took down. So there is a lot of risk along the way. Now, there is a point where government does have to watch out for the little guy for abusive practices, because we don't want to let free market capitalism go so awry that you end up with, five guys controlling the entire world in their own little fiefdoms with private armies, like these guys used to use Pinkerton back then. So you have to find a healthy balance. The problem, and we have some great laws in the book. I mean, some of the things that we do, some of the trust-busting laws that are in the book absolutely were required, but we don't have a healthy pendulum mentality here, because look what we do. Instead of unions were a really good counter to getting rid of abusive labor practices, for creating safer work environments, for stopping child labor abuse and all these things, but then where are we now? Now unions are the evil. Now we've gotten to a point where we have unions who, if you don't vote the way we want, in open card ballots, and you don't do this, you're a pariah. Unions have destroyed school system, not teachers. Unions destroyed, to a large extent, and a lot of people on K Street destroyed the education. And so one of the things we really have to go back to doing is government needs to stop micromanaging. Government needs to set certain bounds. You are free to do whatever you want. There's no limit in how much money you can make. There's no limit in how many things you can invest in, for example. But, there are certain limits, and we have things like that. We have, wage, having to pay overtime. I mean, there are certain things that I'm perfectly fine with government doing. But let me just go back to, I want to tie this to your infrastructure conversation. Government should not be deciding what bridge to build and where. Government should be calling for, government should be supporting or promoting, maybe even giving tax incentives. But we have to find a way to let private industry do these things, because they will always, always, always find a better solution. I would argue Obama's America would never have made America anything like we are today. We would have looked a lot more like Cuba. Look what happened to Venezuela. All that oil wealth, forget the recent decline, but look at what happened to Venezuela. The minute these communist kleptocrats came in and tried to take over, immediately Venezuela, even after stealing all those assets of American oil and other heavy industries that had equipment there, they seized all those assets, and it's still a dying business model. And yet Obama wants to gear more and more towards that business model. No wonder we hold a little vitriol on the final say.
Listen, any of my thoughts towards Barack Obama are well warranted, and it's not my actions that have created the feelings that I have towards him and his policies. It's his actions and actual results. And I'm gonna bring up something, because I'm extremely upset with the direction the FCC is taking towards the control of the internet, and I'll explain to you why. You know, this country walked away from manufacturing. Whatever excuses you want to come up with, oh, blame it on the unions, blame it on this. The fact is, if this country wanted to, we could have continued to manufacture at a much greater pace. We could have made course corrections to keep competitive, but we just took the easy way out and said it's easier to take advantage of cheap and whatever labor overseas. And as a result, like everything else, when you give away too many of your own secrets, when you give away industries, when you give up things that are so vital, it bites you in the you-know-what down the road, and it has. So I bring this up specifically because we're talking about results here, John. But the bottom line is, it is the internet and advances in technology, specifically with companies related to that, whether it be Microsoft or Google or Intel or you name it, Dell. I mean, we could name a whole host of different Ciscos and so on and so forth. There's thousands of companies that have done incredibly well and created a lot of wealth and a lot of great jobs and have built up cities, in fact, based on that wealth, right? And that only happened because there was a whole new Wild West. There was a whole new frontier to be explored and innovated and I don't care if you want to call it dominated, but that's exactly what happened. And so the second the government's going to get its paws into it, and it's going to start taxing and feeing and thising and regulating and all the stuff that's going to come, it's going to stifle any future growth to the point where other countries who are now getting into the game, who are still behind us and have too many issues due to the types of systems that they run under, will gain an advantage because our own government will destroy our new frontier. Exactly what I think Obama has in his mind. Because let me tell you, I don't doubt this for a second, that Valerie Jout and he and whoever else want to sit down have to sit down and have these conversations of what could we hurt next? How could we bring this country back a step further? What could we do? Because there's no other explanation for it. You can't be this stupid. I mean, no matter, he could have been handed a degree. I don't care. They could have given him whatever they gave him. Barack Obama can't be this stupid. His people can't be this stupid.
He's not.
It has to be being done on purpose. And I want to bring this full circle. And let me just say something here before. Let me just take a brief pause. James S. Robbins is going to have to join us tomorrow afternoon. So we'll have two guests tomorrow, Tiffany Gabay and James S. Robbins. He had something came up. He's very sorry, but he will be on tomorrow. So if you're waiting for him, please join us again tomorrow. So get that out of the way. But Barack Obama,
by the IRS stormtroopers again.
Who knows? Maybe they knew they were trying to keep him from talking with us, John. From talking more honestly about what this administration is doing. So anyway, we'll get with him tomorrow. Don't worry, you won't miss anything. So Barack Obama is essentially throwing Israel away. I mean, I question if he's an anti-Semite, to be honest with you. And I mean, he's obviously anti-Christian, based on his repeated performances at these breakfasts. That just his behavior is just despicable. I mean, his comments. And by the way, his knowledge of history is pathetic. But he is he's like trying to destroy Israel. He's doing everything he possibly can to harm Israel. And he's doing absolutely nothing but help Iran. So what does that tell you? And I'll say this again. John, we're going to save this every darn day until people have it so ingrained in their mind that they finally understand it. Obama is aiding and abetting the biggest state sponsor of terrorism. In fact, he's trying to make them the sole power in the Middle East region. And by the way, that would mean control of important oil lanes and important assets in the oil industry, which he's also trying to do as much as he can to stifle the growth here in his own country. For God knows what reason, we don't know, John. Go ahead.
Brett, out of great honor and respect to the late, great Bob Grant, I would say that this president is a fifth column phony and a fraud.
He's a fake phony fraud.
He's a fake phony and a fraud. And he's also a feckless coward. And he is absolutely, and I actually shouldn't use that word. He's really not a coward, because I don't think he's afraid to use our military resources. I just think he uses them in a way that he thinks suits his ideology. But that ideology has become very clear. It's anti-Christian. It's anti-Jewish. Unless you're far, you know, if you're, you know, like some of our Jewish, you know, friends and family who probably would have, you know, hugged and kissed Karl Marx, then he likes you. But generally, he's anti-Israel, he's anti-Zionist, you know, which means he either doesn't know history, which I might doubt that a little bit. I think he knows history very well. He just sees it through a funny shade of glasses. He absolutely does not like Israel Zionism, and the way the world has proven itself to be, that can only mean you don't like Jews, because you know what happens, how history has behaved. Not only does he support, and we haven't talked a lot about this lately, but even his recent actions continue to show so much preference, not just towards Iran, but toward the Muslim Brotherhood. He has done very little, if anything, to ever stifle Hezbollah, and he has, for the most part, done little to go against Hamas, and absolutely nothing. In fact, he's been a big supporter for Abbas and the Palestinian Authority, who absolutely, every chance he gets, proves he's never been, never will be a partner for peace. And, Brett, something we didn't talk about, but we really should, is that this translates also over to Egypt. He has also enabled Russia to be more powerful, even though he's done some things in sanctions that are harming Russia. By and large, he has made Russia much more powerful, and he did it in numerous cases. It wasn't just the flexibility comment. It was also his actions, inactions, and bogus red lines in Syria. But the worst, even worse, I think, than the Ukraine crisis, and I know that's a big catalyst fear for you, but the fact that he turned Egypt into a potential Soviet, you know, puppet at some point. I mean, here we have, at the exact time when we need the Egyptians, we should be supporting the Egyptians, and we need the Egyptians, and we should be supporting a, you know, bringing Egypt and Israel and Saudi Arabia and all these together in a more civilized bloc, starting with the Sunnis to Shiite radicals. And then, but as part of that deal, force them to deal internally with the Sunni radicals. Believe me, if we put enough pressure, Brett, you watch how fast the money would dry up for the ISIS types. And by the way, if we did it early enough, they never would have had the funding to go anywhere near where they are. And instead, what he has done is he's slamming Israel. He's inviting the Muslim Brotherhood into the White House, people whose own documents say their plan is to destroy America through civilization jihad, not necessarily through open warfare. And what has he done? He's left the door wide open, pretty much spit in the eye of the Egyptian military in charge, who is friendly toward Israel and should be very friendly toward this country. And who's in there right now? Putin. Putin is in there right now. And you know we're going to see some kind of an announcement. there may be a base announcement. This will be Obama's legacy. Obama, again, is a fifth column, fake, phony, and a fraud. Bob Grant, the great one, rest in peace.
Yeah, the only hope I hold out there, John, is that, you know, even through friends that we know, and we know certain things we can't openly discuss, but we do understand that al-Sisi and others are waiting out Obama's term because they know there'll be something at least they could work with in the future and a readiness to maybe even too little too late to help them deal with some of these issues. John, I want to throw something out here because I was just, as I'm looking through stuff all day long, I found another thing that was interesting to me, and it's the mayor de Blasio in New York State, proposes his 2016 fiscal budget, which is amazing if you're sitting down. New York City, $77.7 billion for the fiscal 2016. Some $58 million comes from the city itself, and the rest New York State kicks in. So that's right. So roughly $20 billion a year, the rest of the state has to, you know, through taxation, kick down to the city, which is kind of funny because I'm sure it's the people in the city who are constantly voting against all the, you know, things that would create opportunity for the people who live upstate to create better jobs and things of that nature. So it's always funny to me. But I'm bringing this up for a point because if when you break down into some of the things that they're spending here on, I want to mention this specifically. The number of New Yorkers living in shelters, this is referring to people who have no homes, in recent months has grown to 60,000 from 54,000 when the mayor took office. So that's interesting. I mean, that's a significant increase during his term. So God knows what's going on in New York right now. But he's talking about the increased spending to help deal with this. And if it were me, I would be looking at ways to not to build more shelters, but to create maybe apartment type, even if they were small plexes, which would be maybe, you know, completely monitored. Let me just give you an idea I've had. What if you were to build like 2,000 units of even a single, like a single room apartment with a kitchen, with dinette kind of thing, just enough so where somebody could have a roof over their head and go about living. Even if it was reduced subsidized rents, and we don't have to get into that argument whether that's good or not, but you put in like a monitoring system, cameras in the hallways, security down below, where you can control the type of behavior and things that are going on here, and in exchange, you give somebody a good place to live, but you create kind of like intern-type jobs for some things that the city does need help with, like cleaning up the parks and certain construction-type projects, whatever it is. So you give them lower-paying jobs in exchange, but at least they're getting a job. So on one hand, you take somebody, instead of just having them homeless, and instead of just giving away taxpayer money, you give them a real roof over their head, somewhere where they could really actually kind of permanently stay until they improve their situation. But then you give them a means to have their own money so they could start doing all that is necessary to actually, you know, just be a person. And I know that's real quick throwing it out there. And, of course, you know, that's just the, you know, the simplified version. But that's what I want to hear from these public leaders. I want to hear innovative ideas for getting people back to building a foundation so they could self-sustain themselves. And simultaneously, John, when you do that type of thing and you limit the amount that we're spending as governments, you also reduce the taxation. And if we could also work on regulation, then you lower the overall cost that everybody is being just absolutely brutalized by. And fewer people would have major significant issues that cause them to lose their homes and go underwater, as we've seen so many people do in the first place. And yeah, it's just like this downward spiral that government has created, John.
Well, first off, that's exactly what they created. I also want to go into the if you expand this logic a little bit further, it's not, you know, we talked about validating ideologies, we talked about corruption and ineptitude and lack of measurements and metrics, et cetera, but we also have a lack of common sense, for example. So New York New York, both from a statewide governor, has a Democratic governor, but there are areas of the state, New York State and out in Long Island, have tended to be more conservative. But it's here, New York is usually dominated by the city and the greater metro area, which of course is not just liberal, but tends to be very liberal. Now, there is a program which seems to be somewhat successful, actually, for New York called Startup New York. And you hear this advertised all the time on the radio when you drive in, and the idea is to help you get your business started, to expand it if you relocate it into tax-free zones, which are many of the old Rust Belt cities across the Erie Canal. And you know New York State very well. Some of our listeners are not even in this country, but basically, you know, it's from Albany to Ithaca and Utica and Syracuse and Rochester and Buffalo, right? That whole Erie Canal corridor. It's very good when they can do this and revive, even though the private sector will naturally do that because the costs come down low. But I'm okay with those kind of tax incentives. But if you are out there, if you're the liberal governor of a liberal state and you're out there promoting the fact that this is good for the business, if we reduce taxes and we give you these advantages for you to put your business here, and that's what you're saying on the left side of your mouth. You're saying on the right side of your mouth, but then on the left side of your mouth, which is, of course, for liberals is much bigger than the right side of the mouth, you're saying we need to raise taxes, we need to punish the rich, meaning the ones we need to have a very big increase in capital gains taxes. And what are capital gains? The high reward for high-risk investing, which is how you create new jobs in the first place. So what we're basically saying is when we're selling it, on the one hand, we're saying it works, but then when we talk about the tax policies in general, we say it doesn't work. And this is, and by the way, this is where I think the GOP is abysmal and constantly falls down the job, too. Why we have to point this out, Brett, on the final say, the Rappaport brothers aren't supposed to be your policy experts in governance, advising these people, but why don't you point these things out? Why are we saying it's good here, but for New York City, let's just continue to raise it until nobody wants to live here? So what we'll find is everybody will have a permanent residence in Florida and live 179 days in their vacation home in New York City. That's what will happen, Brett. And by the way, right. You and I know people who do that.
there was an interesting story I heard being discussed on Fox earlier today, and just to sum it up in 30 seconds, essentially the New York Times and this lady, they're looking into who owns a lot of the big properties and real estate in New York. And then what they found is that there's so many, the ability to set up trust and blind trust and this, and then a trust owns a trust owns a trust owns a trust. And they create so many layers that there's foreign people who invest in things, some of which are good, some of which are bad. Some people who have done things that are, very shady, and some people who've done it, exactly right. And there's no issue there. But for all the Iranian terrorists could own, numerous buildings in New York City. But the problem and the reason they're looking at this is because they're finding that people are coming in with wealth and they're investing in New York City and other places because it's probably the safest place to be investing, or, amongst the safest places to go hide your money. But what it's doing is it's driving up the cost of housing and, whether it be apartments or privately owned homes, for almost everyone, and not just New York City, but other places that are experiencing this type of trend. So it led them to look into who was doing this. But it's a great point because, we should know who, as a foreigner, is investing in this country, who owns our country. We should know. I mean, we're so concerned about every last thing that we do on the internet, and they're monitoring our phone calls. Shouldn't we at least know who's buying up our buildings and our cities and our businesses and everything else?
Well, we know who it is, and it's not pretty. it's definitely not pretty. And the problem, Brett, isn't just – look, I've heard plenty of people make the argument, well, it doesn't really matter because if we ever had a problem with certain countries, then – well, it doesn't really matter because it's not like the Qataris, if they became our enemy, could pick up buildings in New York, could pick up buildings in D.C. and bring them back to Qatar. But what it does, and we know this for a fact,
that's
because
right.
We know people involved, is by influence It's why do you think the 9/11 report wasn't released? Because what do you think they don't want us to know? It's kind of like the conversation we had recently about the Vatican archives, right? If releasing the information made the church look fantastic, they'd release it. If the releasing the 9/11 stuff made Saudi Arabia look like a really good partner, then they would have released it. You know why they didn't release it. There's only two, and it's probably a combination of reasons why they didn't release it. One, because it showed that there was a lot of powerful Saudi people, including many of those who have been friends with the Bushes, that funded and helped Carter, that supported Clinton, and all these kind of things. And at the same time, we also know it means that there were actions, responsibilities. So remember, there was a lot of terrorist money made by hedging the market. If you know you're going to commit a terrorist act that you know without a doubt is going to have a big impact, and you're a downside hedger, you're going to make a lot of money, and that's exactly what the terrorists did. So anyway, you got to believe that report spoke volumes about impacting both powerful, influential Saudis as well as their friends here. Because if you have that power and influence, the question is, who's the guy on the other side of the table? I want to know. And I don't care if they're Republican or Democrat. I want to know who's the guy on the other side of the table in this country being influenced by that power.
Yeah, the funny comment I see in our chat room, and you know, it's a very good question, is we'd also like to know what foreigners are constantly in the White House or, God knows, on the staff. We know there's an excessive influence there. you know, John, when I look at – I've been very critical of American foreign policy. And I want to finish up the show. We only have a couple of minutes, but I want to say this because – as we look at 2016, there are going to be the usual names that are going to come out. Joe Biden has already said that if Netanyahu comes, he's already has something that he has to do and he won't be there. Democrats are running from Israel. We understand why. Israel, you know who your friends are, and we've got your back. But let me just say this. John Kerry, who once made the claim to have thrown his Medal of Honors or Purple Hearts, whatever the hell he received from Vietnam, in protest away. Somehow somebody a few years later saw him neatly in a display case in his office. So we know he's lied quite a bit. We also know that a lot of the testimony that was given with regards to the things that they thought happened in Vietnam was proven to be false, were proven to be extreme exaggerations. And so we understand that he's a traitor. We discussed the Swift boat things. We've had Jerome Corsi on many times. And so we understand that part. Hillary's equally as bad. She's got her own issues. We could get into this more in future shows. But I just want to make this point. There's a trend here. When it comes to corruption, we see too many Democrats being thrown in prison in states that are the corruptest and have the biggest budgets and the biggest problems. We see the White House with the Obama administration and everyone else they turn to with major issues. And we can go on and on and on and on and on. If we really want to address these problems, then we are going to have to change and fix the Democratic Party. We're going to have to find the old kind of honest Democrat that used to just create jobs and do good by their people instead of just constant corruption, constant fraud, and doing everything they can to favor the enemy. We got to get rid of the current Democrat, is what I'm saying. Anyway, thanks for joining us, folks. Don't forget, join us again tomorrow, 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern. We have Tiffany Gabay with the London Center, James Isprov after that. And thank you, everybody, for listening. And as always, a good friend.
The Final Say Radio Show is an original broadcast of Rappaport Media. To hear more The Final Say podcasts, go to www.thefinalsay.com.